Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Gohatkar. Mothers being held with their children at a detention center in Texas have been on hunger strike this week. It is the second such hunger strike this month. The women, who are primarily undocumented immigrants from Central American countries like El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras, say conditions at the center are unbearable. During the first hunger strike in early April, 78 women signed a handwritten letter which read in part, quote, "We came to this country with our children looking for help and refuge, and we're being treated like criminals, and that is not what we are. We are not a threat to this country." Detainees have complained about the quality of food, the conditions of their imprisonment, and even sexual assault by guards. Some women have been held in solitary confinement. Children as young as 2 are being held with their mothers. The center, designed to hold whole families, has been cast as a humane alternative to prisons. Originally called the Karnes County Civil Detention Center, the prison was recently renamed to the more euphemistic Karnes County Residential Center. Furniture is colorful and kid-friendly. A large painted sign reading "Bienvenidos," welcome, greets people at the door. But the soft facade betrays the fact that it is still a locked facility. Karnes is being run by GEO Group, one of 2 large private corporations that runs prisons and detention centers in the U.S. Joining me today is Jonathan Ryan, Executive Director of RAICES, which stands for the Refugee and Immigrant Center for Education and Legal Services in Texas, and Samira Hafiz, a legislative and policy consultant with the group We Belong Together. Welcome to Uprising, Jonathan and Samira.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Jonathan, first, tell us about the first strike. One of the women who organized it is this Honduran woman named Kenya Galeano. She was imprisoned with her toddler. She happens to be out now and free. How did women like Kenya organize? Actually, let me ask, Samira, let me ask you that question. Tell us about the first strike.
Sure. The first strike involved about 80 women that had been held at Karnes with their children. Most of them had passed their credible fear interviews, so they had made an initial showing that they are eligible for asylum because they face persecution if they'll be returned to their home countries. And so they were objecting to both the conditions of their confinement and also the fact that they have not been released pending their asylum applications, and many of them have been held for months, between 5 and 10 months, and with their small children.
Hmm. Now, Jonathan, I understand that in retaliation to organizing this strike, that the first strike, some of the women were put into solitary confinement with their children?
Yes, that's correct. Unfortunately, we've seen an array of forms of retaliation taken by ICE to various people as a result of these hunger fasts. Immediately after allowing the letter out of the facility that described the reason for their protest, several women were rounded up as the supposed ringleaders of the fast, and they were brought into isolation rooms, which were dark, in which they were kept with their children. These rooms had a single bed, an open toilet and shower, and a sink beneath which you had to cup your hands just to drink water. The women had no control over when the lights were turned on. They were only turned on during meal times. Other than that, they were just held in dark rooms with their children. One woman in specific, Delmi Cruz, who is still, unfortunately, at Karnes, was kept in the room with her 11-year-old son, Alexis. Now, they have been released from the isolation room, but are still at Karnes. And those people who have visited with them following this isolation report that Alexis' entire demeanor and mental health deteriorated rapidly during that time, and that he really has not recovered. We are hearing that he is in a constant state of crying, depressed, failing to make eye contact. It has been a really brutal, brutal experience, not just for the mothers, but of course for these children.
Mm. Now, Samira, Kenya Galeano, the woman that I referred to earlier, who was behind the organizing around the first protest, the first hunger strike, had been released. She had a bond hearing after people agitated for her release. She was able to post bond and be released last week. She's now giving interviews about this second strike being conducted by people who became her friends. Who is eligible to post bond? Why are there so many women still being held in the facility? Why can't they also post bond?
Well, unfortunately, the administration has been using family detention as a way, incorrectly believing that it'll deter, as a deterrent effect for immigration. And so rather than assessing whether the detainees pose a flight or security risk, they've been detaining them not doing kind of an analysis to see if they should be released to the community or at other alternative detention. So once an individual has undergone a credible fear interview and passed the credible fear interview where they've made a preliminary showing that they do face persecution if they'll be returned to their home country, they can be eligible for release or for bond. And there's been recent litigation about this issue, and the Department of Homeland Security is not supposed to hold families, including children, in detention to serve as a deterrence. And one of the reasons that decision was made was because of the impact that family detention is having on children. The mental health impact that Jonathan talked about, chronic weight loss, despair, all of the other things that children are undergoing. So once these credible fear interviews have taken place, these women should be eligible for release or for bond.
So Jonathan, is this a new phenomenon then, that families initially in these circumstances were being allowed to spend time and live with relatives before having to appear before a judge, and now instead of allowing them to do that, they are simply locking them up because they think it's a deterrent, but now we find out, of course, it's illegal to use it as a deterrent?
That's correct. And actually, surprisingly enough, that practice of releasing women and children from the border continues even to today. And I think this really highlights that this is not an immigration issue. This is not about immigration enforcement or the enforcement of our immigration laws. This is about refugee resettlement and how our country treats bona fide refugees who seek protection in our country. The ironic truth is that today, and if a woman and child arrive at the border and there's no room at the for-profit private detention center, then that woman and child is not apparently a threat to our nation's security, and they are released. So this is really driven by our country's commitment to private for-profit detention and our government's quota, which it is established to keep those companies profitable, of maintaining 34,000 people in detention every night. And so the irony is that, yes, women and children have in the past been allowed to move along after being given a summons to appear at court. And even now, as they have this family detention, women and children still are allowed to move along if there's no room at the inn. It really highlights the extent to which this is really a theater. This is not actually protecting our security. This is really intended to put these women and children, the most vulnerable people among us, in the worst situation possible so that they make desperate pleading phone calls to their families and friends in home country and tell them how awful it is if you try to get asylum in the United States.
Well, Samira Hafiz, tell us about the transformation of Karnes County Civil Detention Center, as it was called initially, and then changed, having its name changed to Karnes County Residential Center. Photos of the inside of this residential center look like they could be a preschool or a dormitory. You can find children sitting in colorful chairs and rooms that are brightly painted with walls and rugs. This is apparently a concerted effort to give the appearance, I believe, of something that's family friendly. Is that correct?
Yeah, I mean, that is definitely the intention. And I think it's very interesting to note that when the Obama administration originally came on, they walked away from family detention. In 2009, they ended detaining families at the Hutto Detention Center in Texas because of an outcry among immigration advocates and detainees there because of the poor conditions and because that Hutto proved that there's no humane way to detain families. And, you know, I myself have visited Carnes. I was part of a tour of the facility in September of last year. And I can say I did see some play structures and some slides and a preschool with colorful chairs, as you mentioned. But that does not detract from the fact that it is inhumane and un-American to hold children and mothers in jail facilities. And I did find the conditions rather dismal when I went there. I spoke to a few women there, and there was a widespread sense of fear amongst them. They were afraid of the staff. Many of them had described that they had had threats that their children would be taken from them if they didn't sign papers. Many of them had been told that they could be in jail up to 3 or 4 years. So it is not a nice place. And even if it were, it is not, it is absolutely inhumane to detain families.
Jonathan, Ryan, can you tell us a little bit about this latest strike? So this is a second hunger strike this month. Women, I understand, are refusing to eat meals, and they're ordinarily given $3 or paid $3 a day to clean the detention center, and now they're refusing to clean it as well. Tell us about what form this second protest is taking.
Yes. And just to connect a little bit of this to what we were just previously speaking about, we often call this the bright bedspread syndrome. You, being on the ground here, we see numerous people arrive and take tours of these facilities. And they come back and we debrief and they talk about how much nicer it was than they thought because there's ice cream in the commissary that they can purchase. But what they don't tell you at the tour is that a woman might have to spend an entire day cleaning in the kitchen with boiling water just to earn $3 for her day's work. And still after that day's work, she's not going to be able to pay the $3.50 that it costs to buy that ice cream in the commissary. And so the women have protested the treatment that they've received there, where, yes, even though the bright walls might be there and the play toys might be there, but you know what they call milk or an orange if you happen to sneak it out of the cafeteria to pay to give to your child later on that day? They call it contraband. And we hear stories of guards taking those little bottles of milk away from mothers and pouring them out on the ground in front of them to teach them a lesson about taking food from the cafeteria when there's perfectly fine milk to be purchased at the center-run commissary. And so the women have had enough, and they determined after the first strike to allow some time for ICE to make decisions and determinations of their requests for release. One woman, Kenya, was given a bond and was released, but many others are still detained. So they undertook a second strike this week for 1 week, during which they would not work. They would not use any of the facilities at the center, and they would only eat one meal per day for the week. The reason that they decided to eat one meal per day, of course, was because of the threats that had been leveled against them by ICE when they undertook the first hunger fast. They were rounded up, and members of ICE, officials from ICE, told them that if they conducted a strike, they would become unfit guardians, and their children would be taken from them.
Wow. So we are seeing this horrific situation. Well, we're not really seeing it because it's behind a facade, and we're only now hearing about it because these women are very boldly going on this second hunger strike. Let's talk a little bit about the allegations of sexual abuse at the facility. The Office of Inspector General did a report, and I should mention, I understand that the guards who work at the facility are primarily men, even though the prisoners are primarily women and children, and that already sounds like potential for problems. But the Office of Inspector General said they interviewed 33 people. They claimed to have spent 380 hours investigating, and they concluded that allegations of sexual abuse were unfounded, but they did say there were, quote, inappropriate sexual relationships. Samira, what does that mean?
That's a great question. Yeah, so there have been allegations of sexual abuse by the staff and guards at Carnes against the detainees. And as you mentioned, the Department of Homeland Security's Office of Inspector General did conduct an investigation. The report about the investigation was very brief, and it does not surprise me at all that it was very difficult for the people that they interviewed to talk openly about any allegations of sexual abuse or sexual misconduct. I think it's very confusing to what and the power and the dynamics of being in a facility and then complaining to an official from the actual agency, the same agency, about the abuse. It's very difficult. So it was not surprising that they were not able to uncover abuse based on their brief investigation.
Mm-hmm. Now, Jonathan, if you have any thoughts on the same issue, please do tell us if you know any more about these allegations of sexual assault. But I also want to ask about the other centers in Texas where there might be similar conditions as Carnes, but there's also another massive facility called Dilley in Dilley, Texas, you know, multi-acre facility being run by the other big corporation that does this sort of thing in the U.S., the Corrections Corporation of America. GEO runs Carnes, and Corrections Corporation has the contract for the center in Dilley. Can you, and you've been, Jonathan, talking about how a lot of this is driven by corporate profits. Is Homeland Security and ICE attempting to replicate this kind of family detention, family imprisonment in other parts of Texas and the U.S.?
Yes, absolutely. In Dilley, the Department of Homeland Security has recently, in December, opened the nation's largest detention center for immigrants, and it has been purposed for what the U.S. government now considers its chief national security threat, which is children and women seeking asylum in our country. So we have seen the opening of that facility. And yes, we have, since the beginning of this endeavor, seen allegations of sexual abuse, sexual misconduct in all of the facilities. And I just wonder, what would we expect? Right. Would our First Lady, Michelle Obama, choose a fast food company to administer her school lunch program? Why in the world would her husband, our President Barack Obama, choose a prison company to create a residence for women and children? It's a setup for disaster. It is something that they are simply not equipped for.
And Jonathan, these are our tax dollars. I mean, they're taking our money, yours and mine and our audience's money, giving it to GEO and Corrections Corporation to imprison mothers and children in these giant facilities. I understand one estimate says something like it costs them, costs taxpayers more than $200 a day to house these folks per person, about what it would cost, you know, to go to a hotel or to pay a hotel per night. I mean, and that's, you know, and then making these women work all day to earn $3, not even enough to buy an ice cream. I mean, it's just, it sounds like it's essentially a corporate giveaway to these big groups at the expense of the well-being of vulnerable people.
That's absolutely right. And I hate to burst your bubble, but I don't think that you or I or any of the people watching or listening this show have ever stayed at a hotel for $350 a night. But that, in fact, is the price of maintaining these families. Wow. I have a client from Mexico who approached the U.S. border on the advice of the U.S. consulate because her U.S. citizen son, 23-year-old U.S. citizen son, was disappeared by the Mexican Marines. She was advised by the U.S. consulate to approach the border and request asylum with her family. They were all placed into her and her children into family detention, her husband into adult detention. And they remained for 3 months in detention at this exorbitant price. Now, why is the U.S. government not investigating the disappearance of her U.S. citizen son in Mexico? Because we were told by the consulate they don't have the resources.
Wow. Samira Hafiz, yes, go ahead.
Yeah, and I just wanted to add two things. That one of the things that makes the allegations of sexual misconduct and sexual abuse especially appalling is that many of the detainees are actually survivors of sexual assault. Yes. And other forms of domestic violence and violence against women. And for them to not only be re-traumatized by being put in detention with their children, but then undergoing further abuse by the staff that's assigned to protect them and keep them safe is especially appalling. And the other point I would like to make is that Jonathan talked about the price of immigration detention, and alternatives to detention, such as release or community support programs, cost far, far less. Some cost pennies per day. So it's just it makes no sense to detain people at that cost.
And I should
mention, there are even cheaper solutions in that these private detention centers sell themselves as providing a service. But the truth is that almost all of these women have relatives and family in the United States who would pay for all of their living costs. We are choosing as taxpayers to pay for their living costs when private individuals are willing to foot the bill. There are cheaper solutions. It could be free. for the United States taxpayer.
Right. If we were just measuring by money, and then if we were measuring by ethics, it would also make sense to provide freedom for these women and babies. I mean, babies as young as two. I'm imagining my toddler.
27 days. 27 days old is the youngest child we've seen.
Oh, my goodness.
Imagine that prison ID.
Yeah. So finally, there was a huge controversy last year over the large wave of children coming to the U.S. unaccompanied from Central America, and that exodus was apparently stemmed. There was a lot of controversy around, you know, with Congress and a lot of misinformation around that. What is the current situation of unaccompanied minors as well as minors crossing with their mothers? Are there still large numbers coming across the border for various reasons, economic violence, political violence, etc., organized crime, or have the numbers actually dropped, Jonathan?
Yes, well, our organization, RAISIS, conducts about 20% of the nation's intakes, legal screenings for unaccompanied children who are in the custody of U.S. Health and Human Services. And I would distinguish that form of custody from the custody in which these women and children are placed. Hmm. U.S. Health and Human Services runs shelters that have the single purpose of identifying family members in the country to whom these children can be placed in their custody. But this is a seasonal phenomenon, and certainly this is the season when refugees and displaced people tend to move north. And so, yes, I can report that we are seeing increases in the numbers of at the shelters. There are increases in the numbers of women and children who are coming, but it is lower than last year. This is really mainly due not to the deterrent strategy of family detention, but unfortunately of the harsh interdiction strategy that our government has funded in Mexico and in the Northern Triangle nations, where special forces are basically lining the borders with machine guns, like armies, preventing these displaced persons from moving north.
Wow.
So they will be increased numbers because there's increasing violence in these countries. That is the reason for their movement. They are fleeing unspeakable violence.
Right.
So they will continue to come, but we are interdicting them along the way.
Well, I want to thank the two of you so much for joining us today and shedding some light on these issues. Can you both very briefly give out websites for your organization? First Jonathan and then Samira.
You can visit RAISESTexas.org. That's RAISESTexas.org.
And Samira Hafez?
Yes, you can learn more about the We Belong Together campaign at WeBelongTogether.org.
And we will post those on our website, UprisingWithSonali.com, later today as well in case you missed them. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you, Sonali.
Thanks for your time.
Jonathan Ryan is the executive director of RAISES, which stands for the Refugee and Immigrant Center for Education and Legal Services in Texas. Samira Hafez is a legislative and policy consultant with the group We Belong Together. This is Uprising. We'll be right back.